question of Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 5.
This is the Historical Society of Alaska in meeting, listening to the remarks of Mr. Paul Ip Liam, a boy that was born in Fairbanks a few years ago, telling of his life experience. The first thing I would like to ask Paul Ip Liam, how he comes to that Ip.
Well, Bob, in the early days in Fairbanks, there used to be a candy store, the Herring family. You've heard of Art Herring and Shorty Herring and so forth. But the Herring family had a candy store on 4th Avenue. And I was a printer's devil at the News Miner at the time. And during our off hours, we used to go at the back end, and we had to crank the ice cream machine, and before that, we used to lick the dasher. Well, during those sessions, everybody in town, of course, this day is long gone. In those days, everybody had a nickname. I can remember numerous ones, which I'm going to be taking up in Justin's Weekly next week. What happened to all of our nicknames we had for everybody? Well, Art Herring was called Fishy Herring. A Bergman boy was called Dutchie Bergman. Donald Herring was called Shorty Herring. Well, I got by fairly well. They called me Paul, and they just couldn't know what to do with that. So they thought of calling me, because of the newspaper, maybe you call me Pie. That means when you pie type. Like I work the newspaper, you spill it in the floor, it's called Pie Type. Well, that didn't work. So Art Herring, so-called Fishy, said, how about Ip? So when he called me Ip, I picked up a hammer or something and threw it at him, missed him, of course, but my name stuck from there on out. And every time they called me that after that, I resented it, and it stuck. All through high school and everything else. So my name backwards, my initials backwards, Paul Ivor Lynn Ip. So it goes in reverse in Alaska.
Another point I would like to ask is, have you licked any ice cream dashers lately?
Well, Bob, I think that Chuck quite took care of that situation last week in that little story on walking to mile 26.
That's right.
But to go further, I think the folks of the Historical Society should be very proud of themselves, and I must say I'm ashamed of myself. I haven't been out here sooner. I've meant to come, to keep putting it off and putting it off. But years ago, I can recall in high school, John A. Clark, who was an attorney at law here and a very dignified gentleman, used to speak as a member of the school board in high school. And that was back when I was just in the sixth or seventh, about the seventh or eighth grade. In those days, the assembly in high school just merely met to get together in a high school as a group. But because John A. Clark was coming in, they let the seventh and eighth graders come in. So we marched us all into the room. And I can recall to this day how Mr. Clark got up in front of the whole group and said, now it's up to you youngsters in here to preserve the memories of these old pioneers of Alaska. I'm going to tell you how many years ago that was, but I must have been 30 or 40 years ago. But he told us to do it, and we all listened to it. But I was impressed by it quite a bit, but I'm sad to say nothing was ever done about it. He said, now's the time to get it. Had a person stop right there, and you know, if I'd have stopped in high school and dedicated myself to that work, which you folks all are, I think we could have had a lot better history of Alaska. I try to do it. I did it News Miner to make a living. I went out to interview old pioneers like Martin Epping, and that started a sort of a flurry of old-timer stories of the News Miner. But I do believe that I was much too late. I'm still trying to do it as best I can, and wherever I get a hold of a new story.
This society should have been started years before it was.
Oh, definitely.
There's still a lot of material left to gather, and I should encourage everybody who's willing to gather the material.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that this has got to be a bigger society. It'll grow. It's bound to grow. It's their work is going to be something that they're going to be digging up for years to come. I think this Pioneer Memorial Hall is going to have something to do with it. Definitely. Do you wish me to tell you how I was born and all that?
We have a general idea about that, but I would suggest that you start in from the time you became a teenager and got out of school and then went on your way to higher education and finally into New York, from the university, and finally in the armed services during World War II.
Well, Bob, first of all, Harry wants me to tell the old story I told him one day.
Yeah, well, that's
which is supposed to be a true story, and I can't vouch for it. But back about March 28, 1912, that puts me back quite a while. I was born, my dad was a miner. My folks lived out on Engineer Creek, right at the foot of the hill, as you go on into Fox the other side. I've always said I was born on a gold mine. Of course, it's nothing but a bunch of rocks that the FE company has gone through years. Hence. But I was what they call a premature baby and wasn't expected. My dad was mining with Gus Peterson and had a crew of a half a dozen miners. They were in the shaft, well, let's say a mile or half a mile away from the cabin in which I was born. And unexpectedly, I arrived. My sister, who was 5 years old, and I ran down to Fox to get the midwife. And then also called Dr. McCollum, who was a doctor in Fairbanks, to come out. But they said that everything had to be squared away to take care of the new arrival. So these miners all came out of the shaft, my dad and I guess all the rest of them came out of there, and they tried to rearrange this cabin, which is probably a space about half the size of this room. And in arranging it all, they all got excited and threw everything out, and then to rearrange it, brought it all back in. You can imagine the spring of the year in Alaska, you know, with snow. Matter of fact, they brought me in with a horse and buggy on March 28th, so it was an early spring. But in the throwing everything out, they got all ready to set everything up, and they said, well, everything's fine. This is where's the baby. So they looked, and they couldn't find it, and they finally found me out in the snowdrift, under a bunch of blankets thrown out by a bunch of couple of all these miners. Now, whether it's true or not, that was told to me in pretty good. Hey, but Mrs. Chris Osey.
That's a good story.
Well, anyway, that's the way I started. I haven't got over it since. But anyway, after that, I remember growing up sliding down rock piles. In those days, kids grew up, one of the biggest funds we had is sliding off those tailing piles and getting your pants torn, but it didn't make much difference. Through my Fox days, and I lived in Fairbanks on 60th, right behind Dr. Hall's house. And behind us was old Jack Phillips, and he had a old pinto pony that we used to hitch up, and Charlie Press and I used to sell fish, which we're about to make the fishermen every spring. We got his offshoots, female salmon and so forth. He couldn't settle to the model cafe, and Tom, you know, Tom, you and all the rest of them. And anyway, we'd take that around town with this old pinto pony, and we used to sell it, weighing it out, selling, I think, for $2 a pound. Our idea of a pound was 4 slices of salmon. And we had old Dave Stanford, remember Dave Stanford? Well, Dave Stanford used to cut our salmon in the old house next to my house. It was Wood's family moved out, and it was vacant. So we had a bunch of old tables in there, and we'd cut the salmon in there, and we'd cut it up and paddle it. Well, I sort of started a little bit of the business, but Charlie and I used to make, during the summer months, about $4 or $5 a day, which is good money for having salmon all the kind of regular customers. But we always looked down the river to see Mike the fisherman when he was coming in, or anybody who had any fish. And then for winter activity, in the way of business, I recall being with R.K. Lavery. That was sort of a humorous incident. Well, the name of... Well, we started out with a dog. R.K. had a dog named Chum, and we used to haul water from the river, which in those days, nowadays you have water that's, well, it comes out, you know, just fresh and ready for washing and so forth, not too tough. In those days, the water was hard as a rock. So the water from the river was supposed to be soft compared to the rest of it. So we'd bring it up in barrels and put it on the sled and bring it in. We'd sell it for $2 for a quarter. Everything was two for a quarter, two for a half, or two for a quarter for a dollar, whatever it happened to be. But I remember we used to take this dog of arcade. We didn't have enough time to get a dog team together. And his dog loved to stay home. So R.K. and I used to take the dog and we'd drag him down to the river with the sled and all the stuff, which was easy, we'd empty. Take him down to the river, and then we'd head him out, we'd fill up the barrel. As long as he was coming home, he's fine. He'd pull the whole thing, to the home base, we'd take off. But we finally spent our operation. We decided Jimmy King had a horse named Nelly, or some such name. So we thought we'd put three barrels on the sled. And so which we did. We filled it all up. We did a fine business. We're taking the horse home one day after we emptied our water barrels. Nellie decided to go home like the chum the RK's dog had done. And he went around the corner by Burnett's there on First and Noble. He turned into Jimmy King's barn, and the three sleds took down Burnett's fence. So RK and I were out of the water business.
Three barrels.
Yeah. Well, that was during those first days that I can remember being enterprising. Of course, I've never been much success in business anyway.
That was a good start.
Well, after that, Bob, the only thing I can think about, you might mention, is I can't help but think about kids. We used to make our own fun pretty much in the early days. We had a gravel pit out on along the last road where they used to, wherever they seemed to have new improvements, the kids made their own playgrounds. In other words, around the Alaska Railroad, we used to all go swimming. None of us knew what a swimming suit looked like, but we swam there for years. We'd go out as soon as the ice was out of the lake, we'd start diving. And I can recall swimming, and then finally we decided to have a smaller place over at Bentley's Slough, right across the Chena. In those days, the pile driver slough came in at about 19 miles. The Richardson Highway. And the river here in those days was about twice as big, or at least. Well, there was two ways to get to Bentley, so you could walk across the old bridge where it said 6 miles an hour and walk your horses, or you could do what Dick Morency and I did. So you know the old Morency family. I was about 11 years old in those days, 11 or 12. But we thought, well, it's a lot quicker if we went up to the graveyard of the Independent Lumber Company, and we used to swim the Gina Slough, and we'd end up right over right where we wanted to in Grail. Thought nothing of it. Never heard what cramps were. Things like that. Have our lunches on top of our head and swim in our overalls.
Yeah.
But we made our fun, and I can remember simultaneously. We used to feel sorry for Johnny Butterfish. His dad was up from the Kayakook, and so Johnny had to, with his family, he had to sort of help support the family. So he and Order used to be out working in Rickard's cabbage patch. They got $2 an hour for that. And I used to feel Johnny and Odie come home at night with great big straw hats on, walking by my house. I think, how lucky I am, I can go swimming, and those poor duffers have to go out there and pull weed carrots for Rickard's. But that's the way Butterfish, later on, he became one of the greatest athletes of all time. He never learned how to swim. He became one of the finest baseball players. And I don't think that, what I'm trying to say is that we didn't have much in those days for recreation. But believe me, we made our own recreation. Nowadays, it seems like people are trying to create something for youngsters, and I don't think they appreciate it.
I think they're sweating.
Yeah, sure.
What year did Bill
Heath
start the barrel?
Well, Bob, that was back in 1936. Yes, what had happened, part of that time in 1930, I went to the University of Alaska, 33, I went there again, I was with Mr. Cashmere at that. And then I laid off, I had some mining projects, my dad had left me out on Goldstream, and finally settled the case with the FE company, and I got a few dollars, and I remember Johnny McGinn was my attorney, and he said, well, maybe we can get more money out of it, maybe we can't, but you want to go to college, Paul. So I agreed with him, and anyway, I went back to Columbia in 1936. And prior to that time, in 1934, a couple of writers came here by the name of Torrey Ford and Alastair McBain. And they were looking for an uncle of Alastair's who I don't recall. He was up on the, around Tetton Lake area. And Pat Doherty helped me find out what happened to the fellow. Anyway, he died the year previous, and anyway, during this intermission, I got quite well acquainted with these two fellows. Yeah. And they were quite well thought of. Pan Am thought enough of them to pick them up down at Stewart Lake, British Columbia, and fly them in here. And they were working for the
Evening
Post. Yes, very good. And I started a series of correspondence. And I got ready to go to school, while they encouraged me to go back to Columbia University. So I did. I made a trip about a year in 1936. Back there. And through the Panama Canal the way it's going there. Back and forth with John Diamond. That's Tony Diamond.
Well,
he's now a... Yeah, today, yeah. He was just a kid in those days. Yeah, and that was much fun. Anything else, Ron, about...
Well, Gary, my sister, is not very interested in, because she has somebody to speak and send some.
Well, I like to write them, Bob.
You've done some very fine work in writing after your old family, and it's got business like you write only the nice things, and think about good things, but the old family appreciates your reading out. Especially the old family that may have left the family in the States and came up here and accumulated another family and a few other things that you might know about, you don't. And I think that's old time to appreciate.
Well, it's fine.
Great.
I'm just sorry that I haven't had a chance to written a lot more. I don't think that they're perfect stories by any means. And when you're writing for a newspaper, you're writing under pressure. You don't have time to take your story and outline it and analyze it or anything else. You just got to write from what comes to your head and what gets it.
You remember when W.F. Thompson was embedded as a news miner and was always writing about his own family and his own kids.
I recall that.
People used to write letters to the editor and ask him why he was always writing about his own kids. And he said, well, when I'm writing about my own family, I feel perfectly safe. If I should ever start writing about the other families of this town, I'd probably be run out of the country.
That's true. Well, I can recall other things which may have been mentioned here, but I think that as early today things, I can recall one time they talk about juvenile delinquency. And I don't know what you would have thought, but kids about in October would get off just like a tangent like they would any place else. And Halloween came along, it was just something kids to do.
You think the kids of today are any worse than
they were? No, they weren't, no. Because I don't know what they'd have thought today if they'd have seen what I saw and participated in 1923, 1924, 1925, and 1926.
You never stole any hubcaps because they didn't have hubcaps in those.
No. But I never saw a Halloween morning. There wasn't a fence, gate on the fence. Of course, they don't have fences anymore. They used to have fences in those days. Every gate hung from a telephone pole on any street. It was loose, it went. It was all over.
We were out there.
Teeter totters went through.
Right.
And they tied up the chief of police and threw him on the dance floor. And,
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was poor Austin Gibbs. That was the time I think that Bud Boyd was the chief of pulling down his hat over his face, and they tied him up and put him in. I guess they told the story about Tommy Long, don't they?
No, I don't think I'll hear him now. Tommy Long is still there. He might be listening.
Well, this is another juvenile. Is he here?
I'd
like to tell that story. Well, anyway, what happened, that was, I think we call it now, it was about 1926 when Tommy was a freshman. But he was a little bit older than the rest of us. Because he'd been Ruby, he was about 2 or 3 years older than I am, I know. And Tom was a freshman, he was my class, but he associated with Moxie Miller, Eric Herring and Charlie McGrath and that group.
The older kids.
Older kids, they were older, that's the associates. What happened to be, I'm not going to mention who where they got it, but it happened to be just a fall of the year, sort of a fall of the year party, pedestrian. But what happened, they ended up with 3 or 4 gallons of somebody's whiskey out there, and all the high school kids were there. The whole group were there, and I wasn't there, of course, because I was too young, but this other group, John, got mixed up with them. But anyway, it was disgraceful. The town, you couldn't tolerate such a thing as that, so they called them all into the courthouse. And I recall Tom Markham was defending the kids that he always did.
Yeah.
And Julian Hurley or somebody was prosecuting. But anyway, everything went fine. Remember, Max Miller was in it, and Charlie McGrath, and Art Herring, and you just name them all of them. Every kid in high school was there. And the girls, too, but there was really nothing wrong with the whole thing, except they got, just everybody imbibed too much, apparently. And it was noticeable. Of course, it's got to come to a stop. So anyway, the case was on 2nd Avenue, the old courthouse. And so everybody came up, and the instruction was not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. But Tom was telling me the rest of it. Tom Long was the son of a deputy marshal, Ruby, who stayed with Judge Clyde, who was prosecuting the case. And he told his mother to always tell the truth. Well, the thing came up to everybody went down through the line, when it came Tom Long. And he said, Mr. Long, how do you play? He says, Your Honor, my name is, what's your name? The name is Tom Long, Jr. How do you plead, Mr. Long? He says, Your Honor, I was drunk and I don't know nothing. With that, it was riotous laughter broke out in the courtroom. They couldn't get the thing back to order, so Judge Clegg just stomped his gavel down and dismissed the case. But needless to say, it didn't happen again. They all got scared enough so nothing really happened. But that was juvenile delinquency.
Craig had been drunk a few times himself. He had a sympathetic understanding of what you kids were up against.
Yeah, that's true. But anything that I might add, Bob, my own life hasn't been anything exciting, except the fact that, as I say, I did have occasion during the war, and I don't know why it was ever picked, but I did have occasion to serve as Fire Control Officer for Alaska. And it's sort of funny, I was living in Alaska at the time, but been with Pan American Airways, and I'd in my capacity with them and with Yukon Southern, who I handled later in the travel business, I get to know various people, like Lieutenant Middleton, who was with the Navy and tried to travel control. And then I had my own commission come up in the Navy, and I was sent to Alameda Naval Air Station. And I went through training there for 3 or 4 weeks, and I was on the way for my billet in Kodiak. And en route, I don't know why, it happened to be a coincidence, the day I came in, the Navy had taken over Pan American Airways. So in that capacity, I walked through getting my transportation to Kodiak, and Milton said, just the man was looking for, what do you mean, you can't change Bureau of Naval Personnel orders. I'm going to put Kodiak. But I had no intention of staying in the States, but an admiral changed my orders. Anyway, I sat down there. Well, for a period there of about 3 or 4 months, in charge of priority, I had occasion to meet everybody who came to Alaska on by airline. And
you were stationed in
Juneau
at that time?
No, in Seattle.
Oh, Seattle.
Well, then what had happened after that, if you can recall back in 1942, maybe most of you can, back in 1942, they practically strangled the airlines. You couldn't get in and out of here. You couldn't go anyplace. You were there in Juneau at the time. I recall that. But prior to the time of getting there, there was the Navy had taken over. But the idea of the Navy taking over the thing was to route all Pan Am airplanes into Aleutian Islands. It was only by luck that they ever had any planes coming into Fairbanks, Nome, Bethel, or any place else. But through the efforts of Governor Greening, I was in Seattle at this time, and nothing I could say about it, of course. But Governor Greening, finally in 19 January, I remember I was ready to go to Kodiak again. I thought, well, my billet was over with. I'd been there October, November, December, January. And I was out Sandpoint Naval Air Station, getting ready to go to Kodiak. Get to my billet, when word came right out of the dentist chair to report the office immediately. And Middleton said, you're going to go to Juneau. I said, why? Well, I found out that Governor Greening had gotten, in those days, today's senator, had gotten tired of not getting any transportation. And there was about 600 or 700 people in Juneau had to move one way or the other. It was just clogged. And the idea was to move everybody out of there as soon as possible, but how? The Navy rules and regulations didn't call for it. So they just refused him. Well, anyway, Senator Greening, or Governor Greening, called Admiral Fletcher. And I'll say one thing about him, he was very firm in his demands. They said, well, this is Captain Bemis. I'm sorry, Admiral Fletcher is not available. He's in conference. So Senator Greening said, well, never mind, Admiral Fletcher. Have the offer put me on with Frank Knox in Washington, D.C. And further, if he's not available, have me put him on with Franklin D. Roosevelt.
That's a very good
name. He said, I'm sorry, sir. Admiral Fletcher will be with you in just a moment. So he came on in and he they called me out and said, Paul, you're going to Juneau, Naval Air Station Juneau. Well, that was merely on paper. I checked in and nobody's a doctor. But I was up there, and then I worked with a, gave me a practically orders to order the fleet in there if I'd wanted to. But to work with Governor Greene, and I stayed at the Baranoff Hotel, although the governor, I spent the first night with him in the mansion, he offered me a room there the rest of the time, but I wanted to obligate to him. So I stayed there. Well, I'll say one thing about it. The Navy was very fair, and prior to the time I'd come there, they had put an order out that no aircraft would have to haul passengers out on naval air transports without seats in them. They were cargo aircraft. They sent the order all over Alaska, but I was so new up there that I didn't get the order, and I purposely apparently didn't get it. So for 2 or 3 weeks in February, when the order came out 1st of February, planes would take off from Kodiak and Anchorage, and they're empty. You know, we get an order, we get a load, so in fact, you say 600 pounds, you knew there was room for 4,000, you remember, Bob.
Oh, yeah.
So my order said you can order aircraft, weather operation permitting, and a space load available basis. So I'd order them to Juneau and sign Commandant 13th Naval District, which has my authority. Well, needless to say, over a period of about 5 or 6 weeks, we moved everybody out of there. And the Navy knew I was doing it, I'm sure. And Governor Greene sure didn't know it. And he got daily airplane service from Seattle. He was happy. And he has a Seattle PI on his desk every morning. And for the meantime, I was breaking every law in the book. But nobody said anything. I remember a skipper came out there one day from the chief of staff to Admiral Reeves. His name was Putt Storrs, captain of the Navy. And I thought, this is it. I'm off the airplane with Bess Cross. I remember, she, remember her. And Colonel Cross was something or other over in Nome. But anyway, he came off the airplane with her, and I saluted him. He had scrambled eggs on his helmet, you know. I thought, well, I've been told by every pilot, you're going to get it. We're reporting you every trip we make. You can't put these passengers on here. No, nobody else can do it. Why can you do it? So I got to get some orders from headquarters before I change my order. So Putt Storrs got off. This is about the middle of February. So he walks, comes in and said, take these bags in and so forth. We get into the hotel and he said, Captain, I said, understand there's a rule that you can't carry passengers in cargo airplanes. He said, where did you read that? He'd written the order. He said, how many people you got here to move? I said, oh, 300 or 400. Who had left, they hadn't moved in any way, shape, or form. Well, he said, that's sort of rough. He said, I don't remember that order. He said, I'm going back to Kodiak one of these days. When, sir? Oh, it's about a week or two, I suppose. I said, what do I do in the meantime, sir? He went up the airport and watched me load all these people on, a bunch of workers from excursion inlets and guys with Colonel Regal had over in the troops, and Captain Taylor's people from Sitka, and what's his name, the Coast Guard Commander, Admiral, what's his name? Anyway, Coast Guard people, everybody was moving. Everything was just running in and out of the finest, but nobody in Alaska was putting them on. Kodiak was stranded, Anchorage was stranded. They thought, Liam did a fine job down there. But I broke every rule in the book, and then maybe as they was all cleaned up. He was said, I'll give you an order. I said, what do I do? He said, wait till you hear from me. In the meantime, you keep on doing what you're doing right today. So they thought I was a little genius, you know, moving all this stuff out, and it was quite easy. And you're breaking every rule in the book. So later on, about the middle of March, as I recall, I got a wire sent to Lieutenant J.G. Paul Lynn Juneau, man of the Alaska Sector, sends. Send us your backlog of packages, mail, and cargo. I said, mail, zero, cargo, zero, passenger, zero. So then they proceeded, Zay. The Marine Alaska Sector sends this. Order number so-and-so, data so-and-so, United States Navy sends as follows. You will not carry passengers in cargo airplanes. Repeat, you are not allowed to carry passengers in cargo airplanes. Signed by the commander of the Alaska Sector, AP Storrs. So I got that. And it was all over with. The passengers were all gone, and they put it in the record, they bawled me out, and everybody was happy. 2 weeks later, they carried him anyway.
Yeah. That's the way it goes, right? How old were you when your mother passed away?
I was 10 years old, Bob.
Mm-hmm. And your dad died a few years later.
They passed away in 1930. Mm-hmm. I was 18.
Since that time, you've been on your own.
Sort of. Yeah.
Well, you seem to have done pretty well. You're holding your own, I would say.
Well, yeah.
You're not losing any weight, that's
for sure. Well, we'd like to do that too, Bob.
Well, you're now a staff writer. You're known now as a staff writer for Justin's Weekly.
Yes. Well, in Justin's Weekly, it's a weekly paper. I'm known as advertising manager. And I spend my work is devoted mostly to trying to get advertising. Mm-hmm. Getting it. Apparently we're doing a fairly good job of that.
There's a lot of old-timers yet that you haven't written up.
Yes.
You've written quite a few. A lot of people have commented on how much business they found and read about old-timers they knew here. And until they read your article, and you really know much about the old-timers. You knew them, but you really didn't know them.
Well,
very interesting, and I thought
there's
a lot more.
Well, maybe the interest is to decide to know what I try to do, write these articles. And starting out, I wrote Martin Nuffy, as you recall. That was the first one. And the reason I did it, I was sort of a easy day at the Newsmeyer, and I thought, Chuck Wright was the news editor, and he thought, well, why don't you write an old time book?
He was with the Newsmeyer.
Yes. So I wrote it up, and he got a lot of comment on it. So I was 11 to 12 years old. Pardon? Remember one of the scenes of activity, Bob? It was the early days from about 1920 on 1930. There's between second and freshman and fourth grade. Now, the telegraph office and news minor at Pete Steele's store. The Pete Steele's store was the following corner was Labor and Billy's, no second word. And Pete Steele introduced the first vegetables to one of the first time we had vegetables and a nickel candy bar just for a dime and so forth. And bananas, vegetables, mainly. And then you had papers. I hate to say this, one of our admirals in the United States Navy is to give you papers for him, Henry Miller. Put this on tape. So everybody used to jet roll Pete Steele.
May I interrupt? We have Mr. Nordale here, Arnold Nordale, and he very seldom comes back to Fairbanks. And while he's here, we'd like to have Paul Lee Jordan here on the tape recorder.
I think that would be
I'd love that.
Mr. Riedel from Midwest.
Yeah.
I'd like to get that on here for Ken
Arnold.
Let's do that tonight. I got it all right in one basket right here.
Yeah, that'll be first rate. You just keep on.
Well, I can just listen to this, and I've got
about 40. No, they're good for about 30 minutes, so there's about another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And he can get it in.
Well,
Mr. Paul Lee will now interview.
I've got a piece of paper I want to know about here.
All time right here, early day Alaska.
Got something to write on, or I won't be able to know what I'm doing, even since it's my own receipt. Arnold, I've been trying to get a story from someone here in Fairbanks to connect the Nordale Hotel. I haven't been able to get anybody to give me a story of the Nordale Hotel. So I just wonder what you might be able to tell me. Yes. They're going way back. Meredith, when did your dad push into the country?
Well, actually, it's going back to when he first came to the country. That would be, let's see, about 1884.
When did he come to?
He first came to Omaha, Nebraska. He came as an immigrant from Sweden. He had served an apprenticeship back there and was a meat cook by profession. Went to Omaha and then afterwards went to San Francisco for a while. Came up to Seattle in 1888, and he and an older brother went into a restaurant business and was there during the fire, at which time the restaurant was destroyed, and they started up business in a tent. And his brother died, and he had the business himself, the building, the new building. But as the older people here will remember, that was in the days of what they call the Panic of 1893.
I recall that.
So in the summer of 1894, he went to funeral. And there he didn't go into business himself, but he worked in the restaurant in Nevada. Until spring of 1896, he went into the Klondike. That is prior to the discovery, the real discovery of gold. And he was up on the Stewart River with three other men, and he was there when the discovery was made at Dawson, the Klondike discovery.
Was he married then, Arnold?
Oh, yeah.
So his family.
Well, I was born in June. Yelmer came from Seattle when they moved up in 94. It was dad, mother, and an older brother. And I was born in June. I won't say the date, it's way back when.
No.
And then he was in, came down from Stewart River to Dawson during that winter of 96. And then early in the spring of 1899, my mother, and Elmer, and myself went into Dawson.
Did you live in Juneau prior to that time?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we were in, we started a business. We had a restaurant in Dawson. And it was wiped out by a fire there too, the first person. And so another. He was in partnership with a man named Martin Olson. Dad's name, if you remember, his name is Antone, but they called him Tony.
Tony, I remember.
So the restaurant was named the Martoni, from Martin and Tony. And that continued until February 1901, when he moved out to Dominion Creek. If any of you are acquainted with the Dawson country, you'll know where Dominion Creek was. He established a place on Five Below Walker, right at the mouth of Remington Park. We called it the Remington Roadhouse. We were there until the summer of 1904, when we came to Fairbanks. Then we, after we'd been here, built a cabin so that we had a place to live. And in the fall, he went over to Clary, he and was. And they cut logs down on the San Diego River at the mouth of Poker Creek. And this is rather an interesting thing. Every once in a while I see Henry Roden, and when we get together.
Henry Roden.
Roden, yeah. Roden. We have discussions about the old times. We'd like to tell how he was down on the San Diego River at the same time. And Dad and two other fellows, a guy named Daniel Johnson, who was afterwards a partner with the Strambergs, Mrs. Strambergs' brothers and Johnson and Martin, and friend or nothing of mine now, is it? He cut the logs at the river here, and they used them square. The logs were in square, and they hauled the logs up to Prairie City. That was one of the best log buildings in the country. It was a two-story building, log squared, and they put keys in. And that was there for years. And he operated the business there, and in 1908, he decided to come to Fairbanks and build a hotel on First Avenue.
That's the one that burned down later.
That burned down later. And that operated from the fall of 1908 until April 1st, 1923, when it burned, and then the present hotel was stuck. It wasn't all built at one time. One wing was built at that time, 1923, and Dad had reservations for several tourists that were coming in. London was the a tour that was sponsored by the Brooklyn Eagle, a newspaper in Brooklyn, New York. And that party was to have accommodations for the 19th of June. Now, the old hotel burned on the 1st of April, and the present hotel was established and going to take care of them on the 19th of June, 1923.
Did he accomplish that?
He did.
Is that where President Harding stayed when he was in Fairbanks?
That's right, President Harding.
He was here in July 1923, didn't he?
That's right. And he stayed in that hotel.
Oh, he registered in there?
Yes, and we still have that.
That's an amazing, yeah.
Yes, we have that as well.
Amazing, they put a hotel up in 2 or 3 months.
But then, of course, the hotel has been large and
Oh, yeah.
But the hotel is tearing down the Grand
Hotel. No, it is not. It is known as the Grand Hotel. Yes, it is the Grand Hotel.
The one question, Arnold, I remember through the years as a little kid, on the 4th of July, any celebration we had, we always had a band out with old man Gobra and Pop Wing and all the rest of them. I always saw about a half a dozen Nordale kids. How come you fellows all fit the music?
We had to create our own entertainment, you mentioned that earlier.
I remember you played the cornet, Jommer played something, and Tubby played the tuba, didn't he?
The bass horn, yes, too.
And Great Greg Sousaphone. But you remember that, Paul, can't you?
Yeah.
You only had between the Bentley brothers and the Nordale brothers, and that was about it. Maybe Costin, Clifford Smith, and...
Oh, we always had Tommy King, you know.
Tommy King. And didn't Rhodey play Rhodey Davis?
Yeah,
Rhodey
and
Blood
the Cornet.
Yeah. And who played the drums?
Well, it was Tommy King.
Tommy King, and Dan Bammer used to scratch the piano.
Well, yes, well,
that was
the organ. Dan used to play the bass drum, and Tommy the professional
drummer. That's the same band that there was a Victor
Midnight,
and he played the alto.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
baritone.
Yeah, baritone.
Yeah, but I remember this. Our big celebrations here, I can recall, were for the 21st of June, the Midnight Sun, and then we had the 4th of July. Well, then we used to have to go out and watch Bobby Sheldon and Tom Gibson, who had to break their necks out of the field.
I want to tell you something about a band and this Bobby Sheldon.
Yeah, that's right. He was the main center of attraction.
Well, this created quite a stir at the moment. We had been down to Indiana.
Yeah.
They were having a ball game down there, and the rivalry between Indiana and Fairbanks in those days was quite fierce. Well, we had to travel by boat.
That's right.
You know, and the band was down there to provide a little soothing music to the feelings of the people. And it happened that Fairbanks lost. Well,
I'm lying.
I don't want to get into our new store. But anyway, Fairbanks lost, and on the way up, they realized that they had to do something to put the people of Fairbanks in a fairly good humor. So it was decided that they were going to have a tune, which is a proper thing to have. So they had picked up a corpse. They took all the bats and the masks and everything that they had, and they fixed it up on a kind of a stretcher. And they had that Bob was dressed up as a widow in mourning. And when he came up here, the boat came right up to the surface. The boat blew the deck with it. And everybody rushed down to see what was happening.
It brought everybody in the fire. They had the doctor
and the
marshal,
and they all came. So the band got off. Then came the widow.
Well,
he caught the next, I guess, after the band. And then came Bob and the widow. And then everybody walked up the street to become a boat with their hats off. And like that, and of course, going right into it. Well, I don't know what the marshal was suburban. And the fact that they did him down to a demonstration like that annoyed him. I thought that they were going to put Bob Sheldon in the jail.
Dr. Sutherland was mad too. The reason we lost the ball game, about which I lost 50 bucks, pitcher, who was Harvey Marlin Dundle, we had the ball game once. We had it in the bag. But he was throwing a curve toward the last of the game there and broke his arm. Throwing a curve, broke his arm. That cooked our goose. We lost it. We had no other pitcher. We were through. And Indiana won the ball game. Steve Wendell. Oh, that's Wendell's boy.
Yes.
I'm a pitcher, but. I didn't think a man could
break
his
arm
throwing a third ball, but he did.
The pitcher for Indiana at that time was Ike Taylor.
Yeah.
Taylor Highway. Ike was the Indiana pitcher.
Yeah. Do you remember after when George Eprick pitched? I remember him myself.
That's right.
You're talking about a few years before that, apparently.
Yeah.
Arnold, did you ever know a fellow named Danny McGinty? McCarthy.
Oh, Danny Carter.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Well, what was the story about him in the early days? Was he fabulous as they say he was? They said he was going to Sam Godfrey. He's the one who struck Fairbanks Creek.
Well, yeah. Actually, it was Dan's father, you might say. Dan's father and old Tom Meehan. Tom Meehan was there. They called the post office, Fairbanks Creek, Meehan Post Office.
Yeah.
And the little settlement was Meehan.
You remember Danny McCarty, you know?
Yes,
sir. What kind of character was he? I understand his wife shot him in 1919 or something like that.
Yeah. Nice guy. He was just a character.
Well, I mean, maybe he just in and outer, or?
That's right.
Just a character.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Actually, he didn't produce anything as far as the company.
Yeah. Produced a lot of gold.
You have?
Yeah. Wasn't there shooting over Life and Duty?
Yes.
Yeah.
1919, I think it was, as I recall it.
Mm-hmm. He was lying on the bus over there, and they had an argument, and he said he was shooting. He said, "Sure, I hadn't shoot me." He said, "You went up and got the
professional
for the shooting." He just went and got the gun and shot him.
And she was a credit, wasn't she?
Shortly after that, there was a group here in Fairbanks wanted to start an organization to keep shoot. When I cut my head off and I said, my son, we're in danger of another shoot. He came out and shoot. Someone asked him to Dan McCartney.
Yeah. Well, you remember the old days, Arnold, about maybe you could bring up the day. Didn't Charlie Thompson used to umpire all those ball games?
Oh, he was a Charlie Fowler and Charlie
Thompson. Well, Charlie Fowler played second base, didn't he?
Yeah.
Just
like Boucher Buster does now, and he does it. They had some fairly good ball players.
They even brought the ball team down from Dawson to play here.
Oh, yeah.
And
Fort Gibbon.
Fort Gibbon used to come up, the army of Fort Gibbon.
Yeah. Julie
used to come up to here.
Not in those days, Cordova came here once.
I remember
Cordova came here in 1922.
Jim
Hutchinson
was one of the
ball players
here.
That's right. Yeah. But Indiana had him that year, I think, had him beat pretty badly. I mean, all the way around, as I recall.
They had a bunch of young fellas down there on the
waiver. Well, but the only pitcher that we had here, may I say so, was Chuck Lewis. He was a good pitcher.
Chuck Lewis
was the finest, yeah.
Of course,
very stylish pitcher.
Go back to our days, there was Ric Flair, and there was Wakefield.
You recall Arnold in the old days of the Armory. When was that building first built there on 4th Avenue, where the medical center is right now, Fermi's Medical Center?
If I remember rightly, that was built in 1926 by F.F. Gordon and Gordon's Rotary.
Armory that late?
1906.
Oh, 1906. I thought you said
1906.
Oh, yes. That sounds right.
I'm pretty sure that that's right because Frank Gordon and Peggy Gordon were married in 1907, and they held the reception in the ring.
Do you recall 1920? The fall of 1923, in the same armory when Ben Ilson and Bus Boyd and
I was known.
You were known. Do you remember that, Paul? We used to play basketball in there. Were you there then? Yeah. We used to play basketball in there. That was the first gym we ever had in Fairbanks.
Those pumps that were held there.
We skate right afterwards and everything else, but roller skating and everything.
That went on when it was a garage.
The Recreation Center. Wasn't that right? Well, I'm going to get back to the old days of Bartels. Do you remember these old, some of these old saloons and nightclubs and so forth? After that, you've been here, but they've often mentioned to me about different spots that were supposed to have been here. On the corner of First and Lacey, what was that? That was that building, please, room?
That was the Washington Saloon there. It was owned by Bill McPhee, W.H. McPhee, and it was later transformed, I think, into this part of a standard garage that was operated by Paul Hammond,
yes. And then later, down in the other corner was in the corner of First and Cushman was another saloon that later burned.
Well, actually,
Charlie Thompson.
How is it that you were asking me about these saloons?
Well, Mr. Justin mentioned the other day he was trying to find out who was the one on Fourth and Cushman on the corner.
Fourth and Cushman?
Yeah, the one that faced Gordon's store.
Well, Gordon, it was diagonally across, right? And then across from Gordon's store, across Cushman.
There's Kitty Corner.
Well,
is that Moe's?
Penny's Grocery was over there. You remember Penny's Grocery?
Yeah.
And,
Whose place was that? Well, they called it the Flora North.
And the Tammany was down from there.
by the next corner. The reason I mentioned that was that Perry, flourishing in those days, was, I'm great on the subject, but I wanted to find this out about Bartels. Were they going pretty great
Bartels
guns?
Bartels Brewery, Fairbanks only brewery, and they did a very good job. They turned out good beer.
That was on first
Prohibition closed up our one and only brewery and opened up 500 little ones and half of the
basement in town. Well, actually, I made the town of Fairbanks,
except
I extended from brewery to brewery.
Yeah.
There was Bartels Brewery at the upper end and Green End.
Down below.
Who is that down here?
Down this way.
What was his name, this fellow's name? Bittner?
Greenland. I think
he
had a name too, but I forget
the whole town. I remember Billy Bittner came into this. He came in the soda pop business, didn't he?
Billy Bittner?
Yeah.
Billy was.
Well, White and Kelly, Romeo White and who else?
Romeo White and Bud Kelly.
Bud Kelly.
Why don't we hear you old timers talk about foot racing, bicycle racing?
Well, the foot racers in the early days, there were about four that they used to pit against each other. There was Fred Pauley, Wally Cathcart, Tom Dunham.
Dunham.
And there's a fourth.
Longford.
Frank
Young remembers
how they did.
Then we had the Marathon races.
Then you had Arthur Hyde, Gemara,
and
Water the Death.
And oh boy, I don't remember now.
There's two.
Yeah. These guys talk about going out here and walking 50 miles as being a terrific deal. They ought to get up and run a
50-mile.
Sure,
run a 50-mile race in Norman Hall for
1,600
laps
for
50
miles.
A 50-mile race?
Inside of a hall.
Why 50 miles?
The
marathon schedule is
running. Well, they were talking about walking 50 miles. They ran 50 miles.
And
I thought
they did something
in the
old roller rink. Yeah, where's the
roller rink? They had marathon roller skating. That it was 26 laps to the mile going around, and they had to go 26 miles. And it was, you just watch them.
26 times 26.
Yeah. But there again, we can speak about different ones just to skate there. You remember Ray Rorimer?
Oh, yeah.
And then Sig Haast, Fred Pauley was in it. There was a fellow named Larson also, but they used to have these roller skating races and charge admission.
They started just dancing, how long people could dance there at one time, too. Like
marathon dancing?
Yeah, they tried that here for a while, and I don't know, that didn't go over so big, it's been kind of tired of that.
Speaking of your band, your early band, both of the Bentley brothers, is that the two that's over here now?
George and Harry.
Yeah.
Both of them.
Why are they so secluded and you haven't seen
them
here for
those
years?
Well, they got so much money now, I think, that they're afraid to come out and meet people. Somebody might want to borrow $20.
Harry is a wonderful pianist right now. I guess
George.
George.
I recall it. Harry played bass fiddle.
That's right.
The other one played what they call the bull fiddle.
The other one played the cornet or the piano.
No, wait, he played the clarinet in the band.
He played the piano. Now, the orchestra leader in those days was Milt Flashman, wasn't he?
That's right. He died a year or so
And that played for all the time.
2 years.
Yeah, Milton
Lightman
died out near Olympia just recently.
No, about 2 years ago, he was out at a nursing home in North Tennessee.
Oh,
I was out there. I took him out.
I visited him over near Olympia where he lived 4 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
There's all this tug of war. He's getting back to the tug of war business. I remember who was in that? Big Nick Erickson was one.
Well, yes.
And Herman that? Bloom.
Herman and Herman and Charlie and Ed Bloom.
They're about
6 foot six.
They were the
anchor men.
That's right.
Tough. And I might say, about 2 years ago, I saw Mrs. Herman Bloom in Seattle. At that time, she was 94 years old. And as soon as I called at her home, she just wanted to get up and make a cup of coffee.
Oh, that's
and I kind of refused. No. She wouldn't have otherwise. She said, that's what she knows. You forget what she came to my mother and she wanted to give me a cup of coffee. 94 years old. And she's now living down near Centralia. And that will make her just about 96 or close to 97. A wonderful woman. And she was here in the early days.
Arnold, there's one character that's never been explained to me. I've heard his name. Somebody had a nickname. His name is Waterfront Brown.
Well,
I remember him.
His
but
name
I don't
is know. Was Dick Brown. Richard was called Dick, but you know the reason he was called Waterfront.
No.
He was a bill collector. If you couldn't collect your money, why you turned over to Waterfront Brown for he'd take it on 50-50 basis.
All his methods for collecting.
And yes, that was his commission.
And he collected.
And he was called Waterfront because every boat that was to leave, he would be down on the dock to see that none of his customers would get aboard. He had quite a business.
And he was just sort of like a bill collector nowadays.
That's
except
right.
He didn't do it. He didn't write
and
letters or anything.
He was always very well dressed.
Oh, yeah.
And a derby hat and a great big tie and diamonds.
One
big stuff.
One morning the steamer Tanana was whistling to go out when I was engineering the power plant. I walked out to see the boat come out about 8 o'clock or 8:30 in the morning. The Waterfront Brown contacted a little Irishman that was firing on the boat. And he stopped the fire. The Irishman had been up having a drink or two before he goes aboard. He wasn't on duty, but he had to be on the boat. The Waterfront Brown walked up to him and he pulled out a piece of paper he had in his pocket and showed it to him. And the Irishman looked at it and he threw it down on the ground. The Waterfront Brown started to make a pass at him. And it happened so fast that I can't tell you just how it happened, but the little Irishman took big Waterfront Brown in the jaw and down went Waterfront down on the dusty street. And his hat rolled over, and he went over and picked up his hat, and he brushed it off, and he took his coat sleeve, and he fixed his hat all of a sudden, cleaned it up, and put it on. And he went over and picked up the piece of paper, and he took out a pencil and he walked over to a telephone pole there.